WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bass player Milt Hinton celebrated his 90th birthday this month. He recently retired from performing, but for about 70 years, he was one of the most sought-after bass players in jazz. He played in Cab Calloway's band in the 30s and 40s. Over the years, he's played with many of the major figures in jazz, including Louis Armstrong, Lionel Hampton, Coleman Hawkins, Benny Carter, Frank Sinatra, and Billie Holiday. Here he is with Billie Holiday and pianist Teddy Wilson in 1936.
To keep every home fire burning for, we'd be so grand at the game, so carefree together that it does seem a shame that you can't see your future with me, 'cause you'd be old, so easy to love.
Milt Hinton is not only an important part of jazz history, he documented jazz history by bringing his camera everywhere he went. He's taken more than 37,000 photographs of jazz musicians. Some of his photos and stories were published in the book Bassline, which he co-wrote with David Berger. Hinton spoke with Fresh Air guest host Marty Moss Cohen in 1988. They discussed his most famous photo, taken of Billie Holiday in 1958, at her final recording session, making her album Lady in Satin, which featured Hinton on bass.
Love is tearful, oh, it's gay. It's a problem, oh, it's play. It's a heartache anyway, but beautiful. And I'm thinking, if you were mine, I'd never let you. But beautiful, I know.
This was our last recording session, and she really was not well, and she needed the money. She hadn't been working regularly. She needed the money, and they asked her to do this recording. I guess the people knew that there wasn't much time left. And she agreed. She says, if you can get the guys that used to record me years ago, if you can find some of those fellas, I'd be glad to do it. But we were all there, and it was the music was great, and she just wasn't in a position to sing. Her voice was a little bad, and here you see her after we'd make this record, and she's listening to herself back. And, of course, no photographers were in there because you can't have photographers around when we're recording. Could have a clicking of the camera, but I can wait until the recording is over, the playback is on, see, and then I whip out my camera, and here she is listening so intently to how good the music sounds, and her singing is not what she expects of herself. And some of the shots are just really very sad, because there's one shot, I don't think David put it in the book, of her with a, she hears a bad note, and she sort of grimaces, and you can see a tear coming in the corner of her eye. And one of the pictures shows the music. I didn't even really see that when I took the picture and composing the picture. I was concentrating on her face and how she was reacting. But when I looked at it later, the title of the music was But Not For Me. Mm. So it was these kind of things that I was trying to capture.
Well, I know that in the foreword to your book, Dan Morgenstern said that as a bassist, you were a good listener, and that as a photographer, you were a good observer.
Yeah, well, that's quite true, because the word bass means bottom.
Yeah.
It's Architecture means the lowest part of a building, which has to be strong in order for the building to survive, to stand. And it's the lowest voice in the orchestra, the human voice. And it's a sort of, as we say, a back of the bus instrument. Mm-hmm. You have to feel as if you want to support. We're Atlas. You have to have that sort of attitude about yourself and about this instrument, and what you're doing is to make other people sound good. We're in the background, but it's important that they have the solid background in order that they might play well. So it's a supportive sort of instrument, and I guess you have to have a certain humility about you to want to make other people look good or sound good.
You were born in Mississippi, in Vicksburg,
Mississippi.
Yeah. What kind of a place was Vicksburg?
Well, for a black guy like me, it wasn't too easy. It wasn't too good. I don't remember too many bad things about it, except one lynching that I really saw once. It was exciting and frightening to me.
Well, you were about 7 or 8 years
77
old.
77 years old, yeah. I saw this. And
what did you see?
Well, my uncle had been in an automobile accident, and I had gone to the hospital to see him with my mother's youngest sister, who was just about 4 or 5 years older than I, and she was a sort of chaperoning me because I was about 7 or 8. Coming home, and we saw this mob of people, and we had to go right by this street in order to get to our house. So this great mob of people there, and they were carrying on with a lot of noise, and it was gun shooting. And being inquisitive like any little boy would be, I just walked up to it. My aunt was trying to pull me away, and there was this black man hung up on a tree, and they put a drum of gasoline under him, and the fire was burning. He was running like a piece of bacon. But the guy had long been dead because he had been accused of looking in some window or something at somebody undressing.
And what kind of impression did that leave on you?
Well, I couldn't really understand it. I couldn't believe what I'm seeing. It didn't leave me with the impression that this was a human being. It was just a body here. But the sad part, when I got home, my grandmother and all of the black ladies in the neighborhood were getting their children, the boy children, together, and they would put black pepper in the socks of the children and the boys, so that if a dog came to smell him, the dog would go away, so they wouldn't be, in case a dog came and barked or whatever. But if they had black pepper in their socks, a dog wouldn't come near them. This is a kind of a defense that these people, and my grandmother had been a slave when she was a young girl. She had been a slave of Joe Davis, who was Jefferson Davis' father, who was president of the South. So her name was, and she took the name of, at the Emancipation Proclamation, she took the name of her overseer, the man that was over the plantation. His name was Carter. So her name was Hetty Lady Carter Robinson. And she was freed in the time as a girl, and she grew up and married a man named Matt Robinson and had almost 13 children by him, the last child born 5 months after his father was dead. Mm. So this poor lady must have had some time trying to raise these children. A great deal of the children died early in childbirth, early in the life. Only 5 or 6 really survived, of which my mother was one.
You moved to Chicago, I guess you were maybe 10 years old, something like that.
Something like that,
It was your first train ride. And what was Chicago like? I mean, you were a kid coming from Mississippi, from the deep South, and Chicago was quite a town.
Yeah, well, it was quite a shock and quite an experience for us. My mother had preceded me. My mother and my uncles had preceded me to Chicago. They had come ahead of us to make room for, to get some places to stay and get some jobs, because everybody in the South had been hearing about Chicago being lots of work for unskilled blacks, because they had the greatest stockyards in the world there at that time, and all of the hotels were there, meeting places of all the hotels and salesmen. Chicago Board of Trade, the great hotels. So there was a great exodus of black people that could get out of the South, the ones that were thinking of better conditions for themselves and for their children.
You talk about some of the people in your high school who went on to fame, and there was someone, I suppose, more infamous in Chicago that you had seen, and that was Al Capone.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was a big influence in Chicago during my early years.
He kind of ran the place, didn't he?
He sort of ran the place. And he ran it on a... We looked at him more or less as a Robin Hood.
Did you?
We really,
I mean,
did.
In spite of his reputation for violence?
In spite of his reputation. Well, there wasn't that much violence. It was a matter of control. Al Capone, it was violence if you didn't go by his rules. But if he went by his rules, example, if he came into a black neighborhood, he hired all black people to take care of the vices and the alcohol and the prostitution. He hired all black people in the neighborhood to take care of. Say, now you run this hotel and you buy your alcohol from me. You buy it from me at $12 a gallon and you sell it at $8 a gallon, at $16. So you make $8 as a, whatever it is on a gallon. So the, anyway, this is a way to run around in the neighborhood. But the black people were in charge of it. And I remember...
You used to deliver, didn't you?
After school, my uncle was in charge of this, selling this stuff to the, what we call flats. These are where the houses where people come and have a little party or something, sit around with the ladies. And we delivered alcohol to these people. They bought all that, people in the neighborhood bought it from us. And my uncle would have me go with him to deliver it. And I got a terrible accident doing that. And
almost lost your hands, right?
Yeah, almost lost my finger. And in fact, it was just almost off in this one accident that I was in. And I was screaming because I was studying violin and playing violin. And the doctor said, well, my everything on my right side was broken, a tremendous scar on my face, and my right arm was broken, my hand was broken, and my finger was just hanging off, you know. And the doctor said, of course, I couldn't hear about it because there was alcohol all over the street, just cans of it. My uncle was out cold. I thought he was dead. He had a lot of money in his pocket, and I picked it up and stuck it in mine. And I got to the hospital. They got me to scoop me up out of the street and get me to the hospital. And this doctor said, well, I can't do anything for this finger. I'll have to cut it off. And Al Capone had heard about this accident, and he came over to see that everything was okay. And the police never said a word about the alcohol in the street. It was just like it was water out there. And he came to the hospital to see how I was coming along, and I was in there screaming when the guy said, you got to cut my finger off. And I said, oh, please don't do that. And he said to this doctor, he says, don't cut his finger off. Don't cut it off. And I have that finger to this very day. And
fixed you have it. Al Capone to thank for it, right?
I sure do. So he was that kind of a Robin Hood to us in our view. And when he told people, when they really got him for income tax evasion, which is the only way the government could get him, he told me, he says, well, now, I'm serving the people and giving people what they want. If you think that these kind of people, the unskilled labor people that I got working, making $200-$300 a week when everybody else is making $25 or $30 working at the stockyards, if you think these people are going to go back to working for $25 a week, you're crazy. And of course, when they stopped it, those people started robbing and bank robbers because they were used to big money and they just wouldn't go back to work. And that's where the whole thing, that's our version of it at least.
We'll get back to our 1988 interview with Milt Hinton after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring a 1988 interview with jazz bass player and photographer Milt Hinton, speaking with Fresh Air guest host Marty Moscawane. Hinton just celebrated his 90th birthday. Let's listen to him with Cab Calloway on this recording of Hoy Hoy.
Come to play bass because you started off with violin.
Oh yeah, well most of the kids in the neighborhood when I was 13 years old, July 18th, 1923, I took my first violin lesson.
You remember the day?
Yeah, I remember the day. Very, very, very important to me. And I played the violin in the orchestra. And then 1929, Al Jolson made the first sound movie in 1929, The Jazz Singer. And in all the neighborhoods, there was big orchestras in every theater because they had the silent movies, so they had an orchestra. Matter, it was a small neighborhood. You'd have two or three pieces, a piano and a violin to play for the music on the screen because there was no sound there. But when he made that first movie, The Jazz Singer, there was sound. Every orchestra lost their job because now the sound is on the screen. It's recorded. So all of the neighborhoods, all the violin players all over the United States lost their jobs in the theaters. And especially in this black community of ours, every black violin player lost his job. There was no place. The nightclubs didn't have violins in it. They had trumpets and trombones and saxophones and clarinets, but no violins. So here I was just about prepared to enter this great world of of theater, and there was no jobs available. My teachers that were teaching me had no jobs. And Al Capone, again, our Robin Hood, had opened up a club called a Cotton Club on the west side of Chicago in Cicero. And, of course, a Cotton Club meant that you had black entertainment. It wasn't black customers, but the entertainment was all black, girls and boys and orchestra. And I'm prepared. I'm at the stage of age where I'm not ready to go out into the world. And all of my peers from high school that played horns got a job in Al Capone's orchestra, the Cotton Club Orchestra over there. And there we were. My parents were making $25 and $30 a week in the stockyards, working the porters in the railroad stations. And here we are, the guys are making $75 a week, which was astronomical salary. And Capone made it possible for them to get anything they want. The guys said, look, I need a car. I said, go down there and tell him. I said, give you a car. And you can pay $5 a week on a car or something like that. And here I'm delivering newspapers for $9 a week because I'm still playing this violin. I know it's much music, but I don't have it. The thing. I'm playing this violin, and I'm delivering newspapers. And these guys are getting off at 5 o'clock in the morning from these nightclubs, and I'm just beginning to go out with my newspapers. And I would be so embarrassed. I would hide. I wouldn't let them see me. They had disc Ford cars with disc wheels, and that's when I said, heck, I got to get me another instrument. So I thought it was quite easy to come from violin to bass because they're both string instruments and they both have four strings.
And was it easy? Was that an easy transition for you?
It was the easiest.
I mean, they're four strings, but yeah, it's this.
Well, four, so yeah, they're exactly backwards. The violin is E-A-D-G and the bass is D-G-A-E. So fourths become fifths on inversions when you study harmony.
Yeah.
If you turn it around, you can count it around, it fourths becomes fifths. So that wasn't too bad of a conversion for me. I was accustomed to strings, even though this was a big one. And I thought I'd try that, and it worked out very well. I kept practicing on it until some old bass player got too drunk to make his engagement.
That's right, he stepped
in. And he said, well, just try this kid tonight. We can't do it better. And I did fairly well, and of course they were satisfied. And the next time the guy got drunk again, they called me and until I finally got to the place where I was doing pretty good. And that was the biggest decision of my life, to decide to give up my newspaper route, which I was sure making $9 every week to take a chance on music, because I wasn't too sure it was going to make it. And I was getting $19 for this one job. But it was very sparse. It came once every two, 3 weeks or something like that.
Well, you said, I think, that in your life, the two jobs you've ever had was being a musician
and
delivering
newspapers. Yeah. And I always said I had to try to do better on the music because I didn't want to go back to my newspaper route. And even when Cab Calloway hired me in Chicago, I was working with Zooty Singleton there at the Three Deuces. And then when Cab Calloway came through needing a bass player, and he asked Zooty, I hear the kid's pretty good. And Zooty said, yeah, he's all right. He said, well, can I have him? And Zooty said, yeah, you can have him. He gave me away. He didn't even, nobody asked me. He just gave me.
Didn't fight over you,
not
right?
Not at all.
Well, you describe really traveling with Cab Calloway. You really went in style. He used to rent two train cars, one baggage.
Right. That's right.
The other a Pullman car. And he would get half.
Sure.
And you guys would travel, I suppose, in the other half.
Yeah.
And he always gave, I think what you said, is a real high-class kind of performance.
He was a disciplinarian. And at that time, he was making a lot of money for the time, and he was a strict disciplinarian. We've all learned so much, and the few of us that have survived, we try to pattern ourselves or any organization we're with the type of thing that Cab Calloway was like, disciplinarian, always punctual, on time. You couldn't get any guy, Dizzy Gillespie, any of us, to be late for an engagement because he said, I got to be here, you better be here.
Mm.
He taught us that cleanliness is next to godliness. He bought 4 or 5 sets of uniforms, and all they insisted that we keep them clean, that we make an appearance on that stage in proper attire and on time and give your best performance. And he was like that. He traveled in a top class, you know, Pullman car. There were no planes in those days. Whenever possible, we went by. We would keep a Pullman porter for maybe 4 or 5 months.
Just to travel with you and carry bags?
Yeah, we had the same car. And the Pullman porter was in charge of this coach, and we would stop in Atlanta and put it on the side of the track, and then we'd go and make our engagement, come back and get on there and catch up with the next train and go on to the next town. And we had our own Pullman car, and right next to it he had a huge baggage car in which he had a big Lincoln automobile of his own in there and had a chauffeur, and we all had trunks with our clothes in it, and we could just walk from our Pullman to the baggage car in our pajamas, and when we stepped off the train, we were like stepping out of a bandbox. Everybody was sharp. He was really one of the nicest people to work for, and he always paid well.
Paid vacations.
He was born on Christmas Day, and December 23rd, he would stop work no matter where we were. He would give everybody their salary and $100 for Christmas. So if you'd been crazy and drank up and gambled up all of your money, Christmas you could go home with your salary and $100 and a railroad ticket to your hometown. And we always opened on New Year's Eve back at the College Inn in Chicago, and you'd have a ticket back to the College Inn. If you promised that you would be back there for New Year's Eve, you got your gift and your salary and your ticket.
Milton Hinton, it's been wonderful to talk with you. I thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me aboard.
Milton Hinton speaking with Fresh Air guest host Marty Moscawen in 1988. Hinton just celebrated his 90th birthday. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.